Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated July 29th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On the front page, above the fold, our first article is entitled "SyQuest Plots Steady Growth Post-IPO" by Monica Chin from Cary. Nearly a year after its $56 million initial public offering, SyQuest Incorporated has continued hiring to boost product development and client services, and analysts say the Cary e-procurement company has opportunities to expand into new markets. SyQuest has been on a steady hiring streak for the past year. The company has 240 employees total, up from 162 at the start of 2010. The company has hired 45 people in 2011 and will hire another 35 by the end of the year, says Ann Thomas, Vice President of Human Resources. The hirings are split 60-40 between client delivery, which oversees the procurement process with clients, and software development. Thomas characterizes the growth as conservative. Quote, "We're not looking to go out and hire 100 people at a time," she says. "We want to make sure our business supports it," end quote. By all indications, the company, with an annualized revenue rate of $50 million, is growing. Revenue in the first quarter of 2011 was $12.5 million, up 23.8% from the first quarter of 2010. Net income from the same period was $424,000, down from $1.9 million a year ago, largely as the result of increased operating expenses. From its IPO stock price of $9.50, SyQuest's stock climbed to above $18 a share in the past year. It's now in the $16 to $17 range. As for customers, the company had 207 in June 2010. By the end of its first quarter of 2011, it had 313 customers, including Biogen, IDEC, Stanford University, Amgen, and the state of Georgia. Second quarter 2011 earnings will be out August 4th. The hirings indicate that SyQuest is focused on two aspects of its business strategy. One, to keep existing customers happy by boosting client delivery. Two, to strengthen its products, for which the company rolls out enhancements and upgrades three times a year. SyQuest's cloud-based procurement business model bets on building specialized knowledge in particular industries rather than delivering generalized procurement services. To attract and retain clients, then, SyQuest needs to build a solid product suite and customer service for good word of mouth. SyQuest boasts a source-to-settle business that caters to the higher education, life science, state and local government, and healthcare industries. Its backlog is strong and increasing. For 2010, 86% of the company's revenue came from backlog, while 9% came from new sales, compared with 57% backlog in 2009. The business model offers some advantages and disadvantages. On the one hand, the recession has caused companies to look closely at line items. Quote, "If you're at a company under budget pressures, you can be a hero if you come up with a solution to procure stuff cheaply and easily without having to make the pitch. If we spend a lot, we save a lot," says Richard Davis, an analyst with Canaccord Genuity. End quote. On the other hand, the recession and the accompanying changes in different industries means increased risk. For instance, the higher education sector, where the company has 69% of its customers and 61% of its 2010 revenues, has been implementing budget cuts. SyQuest executives have been quiet on making forays into new markets, but the company's actions indicate that it's looking at new opportunities. In the fourth quarter of 2010, it signed Danaher, a manufacturer of specialized tools that was SyQuest's first sizable deal outside of core verticals. The $13 million acquisition of Houston-based AEC Soft in December 2010 added that company's supplier information network, akin to an Angie's List, that could offer SyQuest a stepping stone to other industries. AEC Soft has market presence in the hospital and gaming industries. energy, utilities, business, and finance service industries as well. Quote, we're trying to engage with all of them, but we'd like to continue to caution everyone, SyQwest CEO Stephen Wee said during the first quarter earnings call. We want to understand the needs of these markets. Once we're sure that we can deliver a tremendous product with a strong return on investment, then we'll chase after them. End quote. Today's lead article is entitled, Increasingly, Youth Working to Pay for College. As costs go up and availability of loans go down, finding a job becomes more important. By Olivia Barrow. Holly Riley drives home from waiting tables at a Chinese restaurant. She dashes inside to change clothes. Then she's out the door again because work isn't over for the 17-year-old rising college freshman. She arrives exactly on time to teach violin to two boys she has taught for more than a year. Riley is one of many high school or college students in the Triangle who have converted their hobbies into extra cash in the face of rising college tuition costs and unavailability of loans or parents' help paying for it. At first, offering violin lessons wasn't about paying for college. It wasn't even her idea. Quote, it was just a good job to have, a good way to make money, Riley says, of her decision in 2009 to give lessons at $10 each. A neighbor asked her to teach her daughter. When, by word of mouth, she grew to teaching 12 students, the profits became significant and the concept of paying for college became a goal. Her parents were very supportive. Quote, our philosophy is, one, that you don't want to go into debt, two, that when you pay for something yourself, you take a lot more ownership, end quote, says Riley's mother. Kathy says, three, we have no money. Riley is not the only student looking for extra ways to make money. With a youth unemployment rate of 24.5% in June, which is typically a good month for people ages 16 to 19 to find temporary jobs, carving out a job is not only more appealing, it's sometimes the only option. Quote, when the labor market is weak, younger workers tend to be adversely affected, says John Quintero, a principal at South by North Strategies in Chapel Hill. And when high school students can't find jobs, it can undercut their ability to go to college. Quintero says, I could see why that would lead people to delay education, choose not to pursue it, or say, I'll work now and get to this later. But life gets in the way. To her parents' relief, Riley has earned enough in the past 2 years to pay to attend UNC Greensboro, where she plans to study music education and biology. Emma Marks, 14, of Cary, has a long way to go before she enters college, but she's already trying to figure out how to capitalize on her talents and avoid taking out loans for college. She says, I'm trying to earn as much as I can and put it away for college and cars. Emma is experimenting with photography, hoping to hone her skills to the point where she can earn some money. Another recent high school graduate, 17-year-old Meredith Maloon, discovered the lucrative potential of her talent for ballet in 2009 when her aunt approached her about giving ballet lessons to her hearing-impaired daughter. Maloon started a small class with her niece and some friends, and it grew by word of mouth to 3 45-minute classes with 18 girls total. She charges $7 per kid. Resourceful parents are happy to find teenagers who will give cheap lessons to their young children in many subjects, either because tight budgets don't allow them to afford professional lessons or they want to start out at a lower commitment level, says Kathy Riley. Quote, they don't feel like they have to stick with it if it's not working out, she says. It's much more laid back and comfortable, end quote. Professionals have a mixed response to uncredentialed youth joining the marketplace. Paul Wingler, a photographer from Hillsborough and the president-elect of Professional Photographers of North Carolina, says the field is being overrun by weekend warriors who practice without a business license and don't pay taxes. He says a business photographer cannot compete against this. He also says that every photographer has to start somewhere and low pricing to get experience is understandable. But the problem that has risen in the past 10 years is that photographers never rise from their amateur pricing or amateur skill level. They're just giving it away, he says. Now we're getting this negative connotation like a used car salesman. But for music teachers in the Triangle, the nature of the market leaves a lot more room for a recreational teacher, says Elizabeth LaBelle, a voice teacher and the president of North Carolina Music Teachers Association. In any market, you get what you pay for, she says. The high school students who are giving afternoon piano lessons aren't going to attract the serious student who would go to a professional teacher. Next up, add aggressive ECB to fast-changing triangle banking mix. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Along with its purchase of 4 Gateway Bank branches in the Triangle, ECB Bancorp acquired 4 parcels of land on which the coastal lender plans to erect additional banking centers to boost total assets and geographic reach. Of the 4 sites, 1 is in Chapel Hill, 1 is in Durham, and 2 are in Raleigh, at Briar Creek, and at Wakefield. ECB Executive Vice President Jim Burson says the bank intends to build 2 new branches in the next 12 months and complete the task within 3 years. He did not say to which location the bulldozers would be dispatched first. Quote, "We are high on the Raleigh market. You know the statistics," says Burson, citing triangle numbers for business startups, income growth, and educational attainment. "It's a growth market," he says. ECB is based in the small Hyde County town of Englehard. It has $916 million in total assets and 24 branch offices scattered along the coastal plain from Wilmington to Greenville. The bank has remained profitable in each year since the financial crisis and has experienced only a modest uptick in problem loans since December 2008, according to figures compiled by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. In its most recent reporting, ECB chalked up a second quarter 2011 profit of $880,000, according to CFO Tom Crowder. Guiding ECB's overall direction is CEO Dwight Utz, a veteran banker who arrived in North Carolina in 2009 from Mid-South Bank in Louisiana. Beefing up the ECB senior management team and modernizing its computers, Utz has embarked on a growth plan to expand ECB's total assets to the $3 billion to $5 billion range over the next 5 years, says Brady Gailey, an analyst who covers the bank for Keefe, Bruyette, and Woods. Quote, "He has been the one who's positioned the bank to take the offensive," Gailey says. If growth requires money, Utz shored up that end of his plan when, at the end of June, ECB announced it had signed an agreement to place up to $75 million of bank shares with a handful of institutional investors. Burson says it was a coincidence that the fundraiser wrap-up came at the same time that Norfolk, Virginia-based Bank of Hampton Roads announced it was putting its Triangle branches on the block. That Triangle deal, now before regulators, is expected to be completed by the fourth quarter. Burson says ECB will hire additional commercial lenders to fill out the personnel in the Triangle branches. In the meantime, he adds, ECB will continue scouting other deals to fill in bank footprint between the coast and the Triangle. He declined to discuss specific targets, but industry insiders say several eastern North Carolina banking properties could come on the ECB radar screen, including Whiteville-based Waccamaw Bank, Johnston County-based Four Oaks, and Washington, North Carolina-based First South. The last article on the front page is entitled Raleigh Leaders Mull Incubator by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Taking a page from Durham's playbook, business leaders in Raleigh have started discussing ways to attract and retain more startup and entrepreneurial businesses in downtown Raleigh and other parts of the capital city. One option would be to expand on the social entrepreneurship incubator platform that Bull City Forward has developed in downtown Durham. But Raleigh Economic Development Director James Sauls says that is only one option being considered. Quote, "We recognize that startups and small businesses are a key piece to the city's economy, but we're still trying to decide what our initiative would look like," Sauls says. Sauls, along with Raleigh's Chief Planning and Economic Development Officer Mitch Silver and representatives of Downtown Raleigh Alliance, NC State University, and local entrepreneur support groups, met with Bull City Forward Executive Director Christopher Gergen in early July to talk about his company's plan to expand its incubator program across the state. "We are considering it, but we want to see if it's the right fit for Raleigh," Silver says. "We're doing our due diligence." In Charlotte, the Bull City Forward Group has secured early financial support through grants from Duke Energy, the Foundation for the Carolinas, and individual donors. It is also in discussions with leaders about additional funding from city government in the Queen City, but Gurgin says no deal has been struck. Quote, "It's proven to be critical to have a cross-section of support from across the community," he says. The Queen City Forward Office, which will encompass about 3,000 square feet of space in an uptown Charlotte building, is expected to open in August. Gurgin says the space is under renovation and he's begun interviewing people for the executive director position. Regarding expansion into Raleigh, Gurgin says the effort is in exploration mode. It's part of our broader vision to catalyze the entrepreneurs across the state, he says. In Durham, the nonprofit Bull City Forward organization opened in 2010 with 5,500 square feet of space in the Crest Building. It charges a tiered monthly membership fee to social entrepreneurs needing shared workspace and who pledge to do business with an emphasis on the triple bottom line of people, planet, and profit. Gurgin says its membership has grown to 143 members, representing more than 70 organizations. David Diaz, president of Downtown Raleigh Alliance, says he thinks the Bull City Forward concept would be a good fit for Raleigh and its entrepreneurial culture, but Raleigh leaders want to research the business model and other models used across the country. Quote, "We need to do everything we can to help entrepreneurs create successful small businesses in our city that one day can turn into a large one," Diaz says. "These incubators can be great for spawning new businesses. I hope we can have all kinds of incubators in Raleigh in the future," end quote. NC State University has sponsored a 14,000-square-foot technology incubator at Centennial Campus for several years, offering 18 individual offices and 110 laboratory spaces for startup and small technology companies that also want to access NC State's researchers. According to a 2007 study commissioned by the university, 20 of the 26 companies that had graduated from the university's incubator were still in operation and responsible for the creation of 900 jobs. Continuing to the inside, FDA's reprimand of Sotera ripples in sector. By Jason DeBrun from Cary. Federal regulators minced no words in reprimanding Cary-based Sotera Research for what they call egregious violations, including falsifying laboratory records and manipulating samples. Such practices, as alleged by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration against Sotera, are troubling, says Fred Eckel, executive director of the North Carolina Association of Pharmacists. He fears the FDA might implement more oversight into drug research, which could lead to higher costs for pharmaceutical companies, which could lead to more expensive drugs. "If you've got to validate this and validate that, it will cost more," he says. The FDA on July 26 issued a warning involving research conducted by Sotera between April 1, 2005 and June 15, 2010, saying that records falsification and sample manipulation were involved, including on drugs submitted for a new drug application. Quote, "The pervasiveness and egregious nature of the volatile practices by Sotera has led FDA to have significant concerns," end quote, about research by Sotera, according to letters sent to both Sotera and any pharmaceutical company that hires Sotera on a contract basis. The FDA is seeking more information from pharmaceutical companies calling drug sponsors that used research produced by Sotera over the past 6 years. In a statement provided to Triangle Business Journal, Sotera officials say the broad action taken by the FDA is, quote, "difficult to understand," end quote. Quoting again, Sotera initiated its own internal investigation of its Houston bioanalytical laboratory over 2 years ago when it discovered the recording of inaccurate day-time data by a small number of research chemists in its Houston facility, end quote. The statement reads, quoting again, "The FDA letter does not accept the results of our rigorous scientific analysis and discredits the company's 1,200 dedicated and experienced employees. The research conducted on behalf of our pharmaceutical sponsors can be and has been properly validated," end quote. Sotera is a clinical research organization that does early-phase drug testing. It boasts of a 99% rate of on-time study startup for more than 750 early-phase clinical studies each year, according to its website. FDA investigators identified a significant violation at Sotero's Houston bioanalytical facility. Research groups such as Sotero, often referred to as CROs, have grown in popularity as cost of developing drugs have skyrocketed. Some estimates put the cost of bringing one drug to market as high as $2 billion, and pharmaceutical companies can cut down on research and development costs by outsourcing to CROs. Quote, "That trend is clearly going on," says John Lewis, vice president of the Association of Clinical Research Organizations, or ACRO. Sotero is not a member of ACRO, so Lewis said he did not know much about the company and declined to comment on the FDA warning, saying only, quote, "It's good it was discovered," end quote. He does not share Eccles' fear that such cases would trigger more oversight and cost. However, he says, "That's a real stretch, I think," pointing out that there have been other instances of fraud in the past as well as fraud in other industries. Lewis says, "I don't know how you ever eliminate fraud completely. You are always going to have people that are willing to break the rules." For his part, Eccles says he does not expect wholesale changes. Instead, he sees pharmaceutical companies being more cognizant of the research they are buying. He says corporate America is as interested in safe practices as anybody else. Eccles adds that the FDA already has good checks and balances in place to catch the bad apples. Quote, "If someone manipulated data to get a drug on the market, I think they would get caught in a reasonable amount of time, and that would suggest that it's not worth doing," he says. FDA spokeswoman Shelley Burgess would not comment on the investigation or speculate on any industry changes. Sotero has 15 days to respond to the FDA findings. The FDA is still collecting information about drug companies that worked with Sotero and would not release any of the names. Representatives of Pharmaceutical Industry Group, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, declined comment. Representatives of pharmaceutical manufacturers in the Triangle declined to comment or did not return phone calls. Meanwhile, Sotero officials say that the company will have the opportunity for the first time to meet with FDA decision-makers since its voluntary disclosure in 2009. Quote, "Sotero will continue to cooperate fully with FDA and with our clients and support them through this confusing process," end quote, the company stated. Pantheon's Path, New Leadership Faces Opportunities and Challenges, by Monica Chin, from Durham. Pantheon Incorporated, a Canadian contract manufacturing company with headquarters in Durham, has a new high-profile CEO who will be in charge of ironing out some kinks in the company's production sites and charting a new course for its business. Since February, the company has been making key hires for its C-level team. Jim Mullen, former CEO of Biogen IDEC, was lured to lead Pantheon. In May, Michael Litton, who worked under Mullen at Biogen, was hired as Executive Vice President of Corporate Development and Strategy and General Counsel. This month, Gary Shope, who has been in various economic development roles in the Triangle, most recently as Orange County Economic Development Director, was hired as Chief of Staff. Pantheon is also hiring for a Vice President of Global Early Development to be based in Cincinnati. Shope says he was lured to Pantheon by the caliber of the leadership. Quote, "It signals for me the company would not only be expanding and growing within the areas of our CMO business, but we would continue to develop this company into a continued global leader," Shope says. But the company has had its share of ups and downs and profits over the years, the downs coming typically when clients don't receive regulatory approval for drug candidates to move from clinical testing to manufacturing. In 2007, the company raised $150 million in a Series C and D offering. In 2010, the company said that it was raising $280 million in a private placement of seven-year corporate notes. Pantheon has been in Durham since 2008, where it has its global headquarters. The company's stock ticker is still on the Toronto Stock Exchange, however. The company has 4,100 people worldwide, but only about 70 in Durham for administrative and sales functions. Pantheon currently counts Merck Company Incorporated, Salix Pharmaceuticals, and Gilead Pharmaceutical among its clients. Mullen, for the past decade, was CEO of Biogen, where he outsourced about $250 million of manufacturing activities a year. Quote, I have seen this from the other side of the table, and I think I understand well the thought processes and pressures in the pharmaceutical industry, end quote. Mullen said during Pantheon's first quarter earnings call in March. He continues, I think Pantheon is very well positioned to benefit from the dynamics in the industry. Pantheon is number two in contract manufacturing and number one in pharmaceutical development services, or dosage form development services, in terms of revenue. Contract manufacturing, which made up $148.7 million of revenue of $170 million in first quarter 2011, is the bulk of the company's business. As the pharmaceutical industry struggles with a shrinking top line resulting from fewer drug approvals, Mullen says, executives will scrutinize the manufacturing footprint of their company. If they decide to shrink them, that means more business for Pantheon to go after. Before the company can do so, however, it needs to address problems in production as revealed in Pantheon's financials. Revenue for second quarter 2011 that ended April 30th was $170 million, down from $175.4 million in second quarter 2010. The company had a $11.2 million loss for the quarter, in contrast to $10.9 million in profit a year ago, mostly the result of a sizable drop in operating income, and that resulted from production delays. That caused Douglas Lowe, an analyst at Versant Partners, to adjust his outlook on Pantheon to negative in a June report. Two other analysts still have the company at a buy position. Quote, management cited challenges across all divisions, including production delays at several commercial sites in the North American and Europe, Lowe wrote. Inventory write-offs at manufacturing sites and high level of contract cancellations in PDS were likely influenced by the lack of capital for early-stage companies. Next up, quick transformation of RBC planned by PNC, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. PNC Financial CEO James Rohrer calls it a weekend conversion. Rohrer and his lieutenants in Pittsburgh, no strangers to making bank acquisitions, have already scripted out their March 2012 takeover of Raleigh-based RBC Bank USA. And driving the plan is a need for speed. Even as regulators review PNC's proposed $3.45 billion acquisition between now and early next year, workers in the Triangle and Deep South will be installing PNC signs at 429 branches, including 33 here. Once erected, the signs will be covered with canvas bags. Meanwhile, other workers will be going over the back office technology platform that PNC will inherit from RBC Bank. If all goes according to plan, PNC officials expect that regulatory approval for the deal will come on a Friday next March. By that next Monday morning, according to bank spokesman Fred Solomon, all of the bags covering the new signs will be ripped off. The old sign is removed and all of the back office switches will be flipped. Quote, the branches will formally become part of PNC, he says, and we will do our best to get it done over the weekend. End quote. Rohrer briefly mentioned the weekend conversion plan in a recent conference call with the analyst. Solomon says the same name change schedule will hold true for the RBC Bank Tower in downtown Raleigh. He says the new sign will be in place there before the conversion and unveiled upon conversion. That's the plan now, but it could change. Solomon could not provide any guidance on PNC's plans for the RBC Center, the sports entertainment arena that is home to NC State University men's basketball and Carolina Hurricanes hockey. That involves other negotiations, he says. The RBC Bank acquisition marks PNC's first since its November 2009 takeover of Cleveland-based National City Bank. It also acquired a Pittsburgh-based savings and loan in a government-assisted transaction that same year. In 2007 and 8, it made a total of 11 purchases, picking up banks in an expansion push into the states of Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia, according to data kept by the FDIC. Analyst Richard Bove of Rochdale Securities says it's a track record that has left PNC with a honed set of skills. Quote, they like to think of themselves that they have the ability to take any bank anywhere and turn it around, he says. To help pull off the RBC deal, PNC recently announced it plans to sell $1 billion worth of bank-preferred stock. Bove says he expects that PNC will find a willing market for the offering. Quote, they are thought of so highly that they won't have any difficulties at all, he says, end quote. If any shares are left over, Bove adds, PNC would find a willing buyer in New York-based asset management giant BlackRock, in which PNC holds a 22% stake. Aside from signs and computers, Rohrer has gone on record saying that whatever cost savings PNC has identified in the old RBC Bank six-state footprint will be taken within the first 6 months after the anticipated March 2012 deal approval. And now, XS Inc. Carves Farming Niche by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Morrisville. In the dot-com boom days of the late 1990s, agriculture marketing veteran Fulton Breen jumped on an e-commerce idea to help sell surplus chemicals, seed, and fertilizer to farmers across the country. But the company that Breen and his partners formed, XS Inc., today barely resembles the one that they and a handful of angel investors helped start in 1998. While XS Inc. still owns and operates the XSAg.com website that trades agricultural products among farmers and distributors, its business plan has evolved into a service model providing data management and software development for companies in the agriculture, biofuels, conservation, and life sciences industries. It counts among its largest client companies, including Bayer Crop Science, Syngenta, Land O'Lakes, and John Deere. They use XS Inc. software to manage point-of-sale data, demographic data, and customer contact information. XS Inc. now is in a growth mode with more than a dozen job positions to fill for project managers, software developers, and business analysts. Its employee roster has grown to 65 people in Morrisville headquarters, says CFO Thad Armbruster, and he has no set number of how many people the company will hire in the next 12 months. XS Inc. recently announced it would be almost doubling its office space in the Perimeter Park Business Park to 30,000 square feet. We're not turning anyone away who's qualified, Armbruster says of the company's employee recruiting efforts. In its early days, XS Inc. generated a lot of news, releases, and media interviews. Its founders started with a $500,000 in seed capital from a group of angel investors that included Raleigh real estate developer Harold Lichten. Breen and other executives were busy making the rounds to local networking events to meet with venture capitalists and private equity investors from across the country. In 1999, XS Inc. found its windfall with a $20 million round of equity financing led by Morgan Stanley Dean Witter Private Equity of New York City. But as Breen stated in a note to employees and clients in 2011, the few startup companies that survived beyond the dot-com bubble were the ones that embraced change and found some other service or product to sell. In 2007, Armbruster, Breen, and the other principals in the company had completed a buyback arrangement with Morgan Stanley to make XS Inc. an employee-owned company. Armbruster would not disclose the company's revenue, but a Thomson Corporation operating revenue estimate for XS Inc. in 2008 was $8 million when the company had 45 employees. Armbruster says the growth in technology advancement within the agriculture sector has been strong in recent years. Quote, we really don't see it slowing down, he says. Moving on to the inside, Duke forges partnership to create social entrepreneurs by Jason DeBrun from Durham. Students who want to impact society for the better are full of energy but can find themselves short on support. A new collaboration between Duke University and Compass Partners aims to help focus those students into a social entrepreneurship. The term social entrepreneurship was coined by Ashoka founder Bill Drayton and refers to those who are ambitious and persistent, tackling major social issues and offering new ideas for wide-scale change. It's similar to one of Duke's mottos, knowledge in service to society. To be sure, Duke already has a strong social structure through programs like the Heart Leadership Program, and Compass Partners leaders said they can learn as much from Duke as the other way around. The new collaboration will only strengthen the social entrepreneurship of incoming students and help build strong social leaders, says Neil Shaw, Compass Partners co-founder and executive director. Christopher Gergen heads up not only the Heart Program at Duke, but he also co-founded Bull City Forward, which works to help social enterprises in and around Durham. He will work with Compass at Duke. Quote, after talking with Chris and him working with us in the program, we started to realize that Duke is a center for social entrepreneurship education, Shaw says. Think of Compass as an incubator for startups focused sharply on ideas that will benefit society. The goal is to help students with their ideas so they can develop business models around their social enterprises. Quote, the motto is that we want our students to create ventures that are self-sustainable, Shaw says. The students that came through our program were the most inspiring group of students that you could ever imagine, end quote. 15 incoming freshmen will work with a group of upper-class mentors as well as the full Compass support system. That doesn't mean Compass at Duke will churn out dozens of small startups. Gergen says he wants to first humble students so they can do the greatest good. We will instill in them a deep sense of community and be listeners first, Gergen says. That might mean students do not create a startup, but connect with an existing program. For example, if a student wants to tackle the problem of childhood obesity, she might do better to partner with an established YMCA program that already does that. Shaw founded Compass Partners as a student at Georgetown University after he discovered that there was little support for students seeking out social entrepreneurship. The Compass Partners support system includes its headquarters in Washington, D.C., regional offices and upper-class mentors to help students with their ideas, explains Austin Yoder, Vice President of Program Management. Quote, we think of it as community building across the country, says William Hustler, Director of Communications. Compass operates with a $500,000 grant from designer Kenneth Cole's foundation called Awareness. In the future, Shaw will work out a model by which participating universities pay a membership fee. Next up, Google Plus debut further stirs debate over use of social media. By Monica Chin. In Durham. While no one is seriously predicting the demise of Facebook, the arrival of Google Plus is prompting some corporate leaders to rethink social media and its role in their business. Google Plus, the search engine giant's social network that launched on June 28th, grew to 20 million users in its first 3 weeks. That's just a handful of early adopters compared to Facebook's throng of 750 million users. But the fast growth of Google Plus means it's a serious challenger to the existing dominant platforms. For now, Google is warning businesses off adopting Google Plus, saying it's an enterprise version is on its way. But the new player comes at a time when businesses increasingly are studying how social media can help their companies. As for business leaders in the Triangle, they say they're looking for two prime features in social media: simplicity and intelligence. They want to connect with customers, and to do so, they want to know more about who they are via demographics and metrics. Quote, I would like to know more, not do media outreach, but to see on an overview how many of our fans like The Grateful Dead or how many like fine wine, says Kylie Schmidt, marketing director for Larry's Beans, a fair trade company in Raleigh. Larry's Beans made its forays into social media 2 years ago. After some fits and starts and tinkering with Facebook and Twitter, the company contracted with Argyle Social, a Durham social media marketing company, to provide additional analytics and features. For instance, through Argyle, the company can write its Facebook post in advance and schedule them to be posted. Currently, Schmidt says she mainly thinks of Facebook as an educational and connector tool with customers. Very infrequently do Facebook visits translate into sales. Sales via Facebook shop or clicks through a Facebook link make up just a fraction of a percent of sales at Larry's Beans, Schmidt says. However, events broadcast over Facebook, such as tours of Larry Beans, could translate into store sales. He says, people aren't on a shopping mindset on Facebook. They're on a, hey, let's see what's going on mindset. If using social media is difficult to translate into actual revenue for companies like Larry Beans, for B2B businesses, social media can seem somewhat irrelevant. John Quintero, founder of South by North Strategies, a Chapel Hill economics and social policy research firm, says he has never wanted to set up a Facebook profile for his business for several reasons. Quote, "First, I simply don't like Facebook. I find the interface cluttered, poorly designed, and constantly changing," Quintero says. "Second, the difficulty in targeting communications to specific groups of contacts is a severe limitation. Third, for a business perspective, South by North Strategies really is not going to generate business through that channel. That is not how the firm's clients interact with their vendors," end quote. On the other end of the spectrum, for businesses that primarily sell to the public, Facebook and Twitter are working so well that there is almost no need for Google+. Tim Ferguson, co-owner of Only Burger, the roaming burger truck based in Durham, says he has no interest in joining Google+ at this point. The burger truck rose to the top spot on the Food Network's vote for Best Food Truck nationwide in September 2010 because of the interest and word of mouth generated on social media. Only Burger currently has about 3,470 fans on Facebook and about 5,700 followers on Twitter. Ferguson says, "I give them more credit than other people want to. Durham is a community that likes to support local companies and food trucks, but this really got the word out. It was gigantic," end quote. For Google+, time will tell. Ironically, for some businesses, it's Google's existing success that's preventing them from being adopters of Google+. Quote, "I get calls once a week from Google's people or people trying to set me up with Google to get my information in their database," Ferguson says. "I find that kind of off-putting," end quote. And now it's time for a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Senior Pharmacist Copes with Growth. Senior pharmacist in Durham expects over the next year to serve more than 1,600 individuals in Durham who need assistance with prescription medicine. That's up from 1,400 in the fiscal year ended June 30th and will include at least 700 older adults who need counseling on their often complicated Medicare coverage, up from 600 in just ended fiscal year. In the face of rising demand for services, compounded by the ailing economy and cuts in government funds, Senior Pharmacist has posted budget deficits for three straight years, reversing the pattern of many years. Quote, "Our budget has grown dramatically and our expenses have exceeded our growth," says Gina Upchurch, the nonprofit's founding executive director. To better address demand, she says, Senior Pharmacist has aims to be more aggressive and strategic in recruiting larger gifts from corporations and individuals. Building on support from GlaxoSmithKline for 13 years, for example, the agency is working to diversify its corporate structure by reaching out to other companies, particularly in Research Triangle Park. In the fiscal year that began July 1, the agency is operating with an annual budget of nearly $756,000, up from $549,000 5 years ago, and a staff of 8 people. In addition to medication management, the group provides clients with payment for medicine or access to free medicine through patient assistance programs offered by drug makers. Senior Pharmacist also provides program participants with Medicare insurance counseling related to prescription and medical care. It also refers clients to programs or vendors that provide products or services they need, such as medical supplies, food, or payment of their Medicare premium. And it encourages clients to, quote, understand that they have to be their own best advocate, end quote, to better navigate the complex and constantly changing world of health care benefits. With businesses accounting for only 12% of its revenue and earned income of only 4%, Senior Pharmacist is working to increase both. The agency has set a goal of raising $100,000 this fiscal year from companies in RTP and another $100,000 from other healthcare institutions. So far, Upchurch says, GSK is expected to give $40,000 to a fund at the Triangle Community Foundation, while Merck is giving $20,000 and Talicris, recently acquired by Grifols, is giving $15,000. Senior Pharmacist also is advocating to increase its collaboration with local hospitals as part of the broader effort to improve the healthcare system. Quote, "We want money from the healthcare system because, starting in October 2012, hospitals are going to be rewarded or punished depending on readmission rates," she says. And research by Senior Pharmacist shows the rates of any hospital admissions and emergency department visits by people who have been in its program for 2 years decline, respectively, by 51% and 27%. Quote, "Not only does our program treat people with respect and all the other things you would expect," Upchurch says, "but it has an effort on their use of health care system, and it needs to be part of the health care reform in our community and other communities." Next up, Harrington Bank on course to switch to state institution. Chapel Hill Company only needs approval from Federal Reserve, by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, the North Carolina Banking Commission has approved Chapel Hill-based Harrington Bank's application to change over from a federal savings bank to a state-chartered lender. It's the first new state-chartered bank since the commission approved the application of Jacksonville-based startup Coastal Bank and Trust back in April 2009. That's because the dual whammy of financial crisis and real estate downturn has worked to discourage investors from starting new community banks. One effect of the Harrington charter change is to make the state one of the bank's primary regulators. In the past, Harrington, once part of a three-bank, multi-state holding company, put together by Duke professor and investment company founder Doug Breeden, came under the oversight of the U.S. Office of Thrift Supervision. Under financial reform, however, OTS was absorbed by another federal overseer, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, OCC, on July 21st. A portion of the banks once supervised by OTS were split between OCC and the Federal Reserve, says OCC's William Rubery. It's an alphabet soup shakeup that Harrington now sidesteps. Harrington's change to a state charter still must be approved by the Federal Reserve. Quote, "As long as Harrington was part of a three-bank holding company, the federal charter made sense," says Ray Grace, Deputy Commissioner of Banks. "Since that is no longer the case, the state charter makes sense. Harrington is a community bank based in North Carolina," end quote. Faced with problem real estate loans and write-downs in the securities making up the capital core of some of the banks in the holding company, Breeden responded by selling off two of the three banks and pumping $3.7 million in fresh capital into Harrington in November 2010. Losing $1 million in 2008, Harrington returned to profitability in 2009 and 2010 and chalked up a profit of $30,000 in the first quarter of 2011, according to the FDIC. OTS had placed Harrington under a higher level of regulatory supervision back in July 2009. The bank has petitioned OTS to be removed from that order, says Grace. As part of Harrington's becoming a state-chartered bank, it signed a similar regulatory agreement with the state, Grace adds. Harrington CEO Larry Lucier says, "We believe the state is a better place for us to be, and we look forward to having them as our regulators," end quote. Banks generally don't end up facing lower capital standards when they shift their charters from the federal to the state level, says banking expert and former regulator Don Coker. On the question of lending, however, Coker adds, "State regulators tend to be a little more lenient in allowing banks to concentrate their loan making in target areas such as commercial real estate to keep money within the state." And now a word from the editor's notebook, Sugata Maharaki. Profits are up, but where are the jobs? It's earnings season, and that could only mean one thing. With unemployment rates still hovering around the 9% range and the country struggling to create jobs and facing default on its debt, public companies must be squeamish in releasing their earnings in this quarter, right? Wrong. Corporate profits are up, and U.S. companies are doing very well, thank you. In fact, that is the reason Wall Street is holding so steady despite the banter in Raleigh, in Washington. Things may change drastically if the U.S. starts defaulting on its notes, but for now, directors in almost every boardroom in this country believe Congress and President Obama will come to terms. According to folks at Standard & Poor's, who dissect corporate earnings reports every quarter, earnings of companies in the S&P 500 are at a four-year high, and they estimate that they will be even higher during the second half of the year. With almost half of the companies already having reported their second quarter numbers, that trend is unlikely to change in the next 3 weeks. So, if companies are doing well by managing their expenses, does the problem lie with the top-line numbers, making them hesitant to add workers? No, that too is not true. Top-line numbers are growing and growing rapidly. So, why are they not hiring if business is good? Who says they're not hiring? They are, just not in this country. And therein lies the diagnosis of a jobless recovery. The incremental growth at many of these big companies is coming from selling products and services abroad. With the cost of doing business at an all-time low, the margins are increasing, and that's padding the earnings reports. For some local examples, take some time to read the full financial reports and conference call transcripts of companies such as General Electric, Honeywell International, or even Durham's Cree or Raleigh's Red Hat. What may be a sure sign that these companies will start relying on an international labor force is a number that comes to us from the U.S. Department of Commerce. U.S. multinational companies cut their employee rosters by almost 3 million in the 2000s, while increasing employment by 2.4 million across the globe. So the question is, how do we turn the tide to create jobs in the U.S.? It does not look like it will come from multinational corporations anytime soon, and yet our lawmakers and policy writers spend tons of time trying to attract them to their cities and counties in hopes they will create hundreds and thousands of jobs. Tomorrow's jobs will be created by companies that have not been formed yet, period. If you quash the innovation by not funding them or giving them government and operational assistance, don't expect a prosperous future. That, of course, is not to say that we should not keep our multinational corporations happy in our state. It just means the supplemental benefit to the state and its citizens likely will be muted as capital flows freely around the world. This week's guest column is from Stevie Ray. Add a little love to the workplace. I was at an all-company meeting the other day waiting to conduct a workshop. It was a financial planning company, and the CEO was delivering an end-of-the-fiscal-year speech. I settled into my chair, expecting to snooze through another, quote, "I have faith in this company because we're the best," quote, speech. I've come to believe that only half of the presidents and CEOs in this country believe they can genuinely talk to their employees, while the other half circulate the same speech from company to company. Maybe that is what really happens at a CEO roundup meeting. After the secret handshakes, everyone exchanges speeches. This guy surprised me, however. After a short time talking about plans for the coming year, he shifted into what he wanted the company to be known for. And it wasn't just the services or corporate image that made up his vision. He talked about how he wanted people to remember the place after they retired. He used a word I don't think I've heard in a company meeting in all the years I've been hanging around corporate America. Love. He talked about the love he wanted everyone in the company to feel for each other. He wanted people who retired to think back with love about the people they worked with for so many years. I was struck at first by the attention paid to the people who retired. To most companies, retirees are the forgotten masses who draw from 401k funds and take advantage of senior day at restaurants. This company used them as a barometer for how they were treating people who were still on the payroll. The CEO didn't just want retirees to look back fondly upon their years of service. He wanted them to think back with love about the people at the company. What was more surprising was that this kind of discussion didn't seem to surprise the audience. I expected a room full of financial planners to squirm uneasily in their chairs at any use of the word love that wasn't, "I love you, you big lug," followed by a punch in the arm. It was clear that this kind of sentiment was not new at this company. These people went beyond, "I love my job," and arrived at, "I love the people I work with." Not surprisingly, the group created one of the most productive workshops I have ever facilitated. They worked well together, not because they could work well, but because they loved each other. And the atmosphere wasn't like a 60s Woodstock hug fest. They just got along and played well together. They realized that no one ever woke up and said, "I can't wait to go to work and fill out forms today." People wake up and say, "I love working with Sharon. I love being around here." This group was twice as fast in decision-making exercises, much more creative during problem-solving games, and disagreed in the best way. They had lively debates in which opposing viewpoints could be expressed, and no one felt belittled or attacked. This group loved each other so much that I had to work extra hard just to find challenges that would stump them. They had a CEO that used the word love. This got me thinking about my work, my family, and who I loved being around. George Carlin once said, "Think about your family. If you weren't related to these people, would you really choose to be around them?" I happen to be lucky. I genuinely like being around my family. I also happen to be lucky because I genuinely love being around the people I work with. In fact, when my business partner and I are deciding who to hire, we ask ourselves, "Would you honestly love to see that person walk through the door every day?" If either of us can't honestly say we would love to see them every day, it isn't worth hiring them. Love, however, is the hardest quality to maintain. It requires you to be a grown-up. Sadly, grown-ups seem to be in short supply in the workplace. Grown-ups understand that love takes a lot of work. My family has as many squabbles and disagreements as any other, but we have our share of talking behind each other's backs. But we temper those moments of weakness, and talking behind someone's back is a weakness, with the knowledge that we could still walk through fire for each other. We make time to get together, even though sometimes it would be easier or cheaper to stay at home. My wife once asked me how, with all the challenges a marriage can face, I knew ours would last. I said, "Because we will work to make it happen. We won't hope it will last. We won't close our eyes and cross our fingers. We will work at it every day, because if something is worthwhile, you work to make it happen. Don't the people you see every day deserve the same thing?" Love takes work. It's the most precious quality of a relationship, and it is the easiest to destroy. When you love someone, you don't keep score, you let things go. Gossip is easier than honest face-to-face confrontation. Judgment is easier than walking in someone else's shoes. Criticism is easier than compliment. Hate is easier than love. I was not given a choice about who was in my family, but I will be there if they need me. Most of us aren't given a choice about who we work with, but if we do the work, we can have a loving work relationship. And that is worth the work. We've run out of time for today's episode. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the TBJ will be available for download from the TRR website momentarily. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long, until next time.